Okay, let's get into it. We're jumping into a really deep, historically dense stack of sources today, and it all centers on this profound question in American religious history.
Yeah, which is, where exactly did Joseph Smith get his ideas for his core doctrines?
Right. And the concept we're using to frame this analysis is what some scholars have cleverly called the mixtape theory.
That's it. It's a provocative name, but it gets at the core of it.
The idea essentially is that the doctrines we think of as uniquely Mormon things, like the first vision or the temple ceremonies, the priesthood, they might not be wholly unique revelations.
But rather aggregations, or like you said, a mixtape of ideas that were already floating around in his 19th century world.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward.
We're just going to objectively look at the sources that trace the origins of these concepts. And the key is to see if they appear in Smith's theology after he would have been exposed to them.
Right. Is he an inspired syncretist, or is he an aggregator who frames contemporary ideas as ancient restoration?
That chronological footprint, that's everything.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning, the foundation, the Book of Mormon.
His first major work.
And the sources here make a really compelling case that its central plot, this whole narrative about where Native Americans came from, was already a huge cultural concept.
Oh, huge. I mean, what stands out is how directly it reflects the 19th century mound builder myth.
Explain that a bit.
It was this widely accepted theory, and, often racially motivated, that these massive earthen mounds you find across North America were built by some lost superior white civilization,
Okay.
and that this advanced race was then wiped out by the, quote, savage, dark-skinned ancestors of the Native Americans.
And when you look at the Book of Mormon,
It's right there. That exact structure is canonized. The superior white-skinned Nephites are destroyed by the fallen, dark-skinned Lamanites.
so this wasn't some unique out-of-the-blue revelation.
Not at all. The sources show this narrative was in at least, what, 10 or 12 books published before the Book of Mormon even existed. It's the main plot device.
And beyond that big myth, the book is just full of other literary influences.
Well, the most obvious one is the King James Bible. Just huge chunks of it, including New Testament concepts that historically just wouldn't have been available to a family leaving Jerusalem in 600 BC.
Right, and then you have contemporary books like View of the Hebrews or The Late War, which people often point to for similarities.
But for me, the most compelling evidence is in the sermons. I mean, they read exactly like revivalist Protestant sermons from the Second Great Awakening.
The style is all wrong for an ancient text.
Completely. The sermons by Alma, or King Benjamin, you see people fainting in spiritual ecstasy.
Which was a staple of 19th century revival meetings.
Exactly. And there's this scholar, William Davis, who points out how preachers would lay down heads, basically writing sermons as bullet points. Jacob 4 in the Book of Mormon gives instructions on how to preach that sound exactly like a 19th century sermon composition manual, not an ancient record.
And if we need sort of the final nail in the coffin on this, we can just turn to Alexander Campbell.
A contemporary of Smith's and a mentor to Sidney Rigdon. His critique is just devastating.
What did he say?
He said the Book of Mormon addressed every error and almost every truth discussed in New York for the last 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah, he specifically lists 19th century issues, infant baptism, the Trinity, transubstantiation, even Freemasonry and Republican government.
Think about that. A text that's supposed to be 1,000 years of ancient history, and a contemporary expert immediately recognizes it as a summary of the last decade of local religious debates.
Right. It begs the question, why is an ancient text so concerned with settling 19th century Protestant arguments?
Unless, of course, it was written in that exact time and place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if the foundation is built on these circulating ideas, what about Smith's own origin story, the first vision?
This is the one that's supposed to be singular, unique, the event that kicks everything off. But again, the historical context is, well, it's pretty crowded.
And you have to remember, he didn't even tell this story publicly for at least 12 years.
That's a key point. And the reason nobody was probably shocked is that visionary experiences were incredibly common. The historian Richard Bushman found 32 different pamphlets detailing personal visions published between 1783 and 1815 alone.
So having a vision was just part of the culture?
It was part of the spiritual language of the time, yeah.
And it's not just the frequency, it's the specific content of these other visions.
Exactly. Take the account of Nora Sterns in 1815. He said he saw two spirits.
Two spirits.
One he called God my Maker, almost in bodily shape, and the other was Jesus Christ my Redeemer. He even described a light above the brightness of the sun.
The framework is already there, seeing two distinct embodied divine beings.
And then there's Asa Wilde. This is even more compelling. In 1823, he publishes an account in the Wayne Sentinel,
which was Joseph Smith's hometown paper,
right in his backyard. And Wilde claimed the Lord told him that every denomination of professing Christians had become extremely corrupt.
That's the core message of the first vision, total apostasy of all other churches.
He was right there, in print, in his town, years before he built his movement on that very same idea.
And you can even trace it to people he met, like Solomon Chamberlain.
Yeah, Chamberlain saw an angel in 1816 who told him the churches were corrupt. He printed up pamphlets and was handing them out in Palmyra, and he even met with Smith in 1829.
So all the key ingredients, the two beings, the blinding light, the total apostasy, these were all circulating ideas.
Smith later said he was ridiculed for his vision, but the sources really suggest the opposite. This was a known genre of story. It gave him a cultural opening.
Okay, so he's synthesizing these elements, but what happens when the theology starts to expand? Let's talk about the priesthood.
This is where the paper trail gets really interesting, because you see these acute chronological difficulties around the Melchizedek priesthood.
The idea of two tiers of priesthood.
Right, and that whole concept of a higher Melchizedek priesthood. It was already a big idea in Alexander Campbell's movement, the Campbellites.
And Sidney Rigdon was a high-profile Campbellite before he joined Smith.
Exactly. Rigdon joins in November 1830, and he brings this whole intellectual framework with him.
And that's where the official timeline starts to run into some problems.
A huge problem. The church claims the Melchizedek priesthood was restored in May 1829.
Before Rigdon joined.
Before Rigdon. But unlike the Aaronic priesthood, which gets a specific date, May 15th, Melchizedek one has no exact date in the early records. It's fuzzy.
And what do the early scriptures say?
Well, that's the thing. The Book of Mormon, published in 1830, doesn't really establish this two-priesthood system. And most importantly, the 1833 Book of Commandments,
the first ever collection of his revelations,
has zero mention of the Aaronic or Melchizedek priesthoods. Nothing. The high priesthood wasn't established for the first time until June 1831.
After Rigdon was in the picture.
Yell after.
That absence is just, it's glaring. If this was restored in 1829, why isn't it in his foundational Book of Revelations 4 years later?
And that's why the testimony of David Whitmer, one of the original three witnesses, is so powerful.
What did he say?
In 1887, he wrote that the whole idea of two orders of priesthood all originated in the mind of Sidney Rigdon and was introduced almost 2 years after the church began.
So the evidence suggests the idea came with Rigdon, and then the restoration event was backdated to fit the narrative.
It seems that way. And it's not the only example of this kind of 19th century aggregation. The Word of Wisdom is another perfect one.
And this one is almost comical in its origin story.
It is. David Whitmer's 1886 account is very candid. He said it all started because the men in the School of the Prophets were chewing and spitting a lot of tobacco.
And Emma Smith, Joseph's wife, was tired of cleaning it up.
Exactly. She joked it would be great to have a revelation against tobacco. Then someone else apparently added the ban on tea and coffee as a counter dig at the sisters.
A bit of fun that became a core tenet of the faith.
But what's really important is that the content itself, no alcohol, no tobacco, no coffee, sparing use of meat, focus on grains, was the exact platform of the 19th century temperance movement.
Every single piece of it has a traceable secular origin.
Right. You can find all of it in publications like the Journal of Health from 1830. And the timing is, again, just too perfect.
When did the revelation come?
The Kirtland Temperance Society was formed in 1830. The revelation comes on February 27th, 1833, the day after the National Day of Temperance.
He's basically just codifying the popular health trends of his day.
Mm-hmm. And that pattern continues with the very structure of heaven itself, the 3 degrees of glory.
Celestial, terrestrial, telestial. This always felt like such a revolutionary, non-traditional Christian idea.
And the source for it seems to be Emanuel Swedenborg.
Swedenborg?
Yeah, his writings were widely available in America by the 1780s. He popularized this idea of three distinct heavens.
And the names?
He called the highest heaven the celestial kingdom and visually connected the three heavens to the sun, moon, and stars.
The exact same symbol Smith used in his revelation.
It's a direct parallel.
Yeah.
And we know Smith was aware of him. There's an account from Edward Hunter where Smith says, "I verily believe Emanuel Swedenborg had a view of the world to come."
So he's acknowledging the source material in a way.
And then claiming it as his own unique revelation.
Okay, let's move to the temple ceremony, because this might be the most rapid and direct adoption of all. the connection to Freemasonry.
The speed here is just staggering when you look at the dates.
Lay it out for us.
Smith is initiated as a Master Mason on March 15th, 1842.
Okay.
And he introduces the endowment ceremony, the core temple ritual, on May 3rd, 1842.
Wait, so that's 7 weeks.
Just 7 weeks later.
Yeah. And it's an outright adoption of rituals. We're talking about the grips and tokens, the ceremonial washing, robes, aprons, the phrase, holiness to the Lord.
Even specific dialogue, right? Like, has it a name? It has. Will you give it to me? I did not so receive it.
That's a direct borrowing from the Masonic script. The symbols on the garments, the square and compass, it's all there.
But Smith's claim was that he was restoring ancient rituals from Solomon's temple.
Right.
But even the church's own essays today concede that these rituals originated in early modern Europe, and that Smith might have confused Masonic founding myths with actual ancient history.
He wasn't restoring something ancient. He was adapting something very current in Nauvoo, Illinois.
And this absorption of 19th century ideas goes right down to some of the most corrosive concepts of the time.
You're talking about race.
Yeah. The doctrines that were used to justify slavery, the curse of Cain for dark skin, the curse of Ham for denying the priesthood, these were common 19th century racist theories.
And Smith didn't just adopt them, he canonized them.
He implanted them directly into what he presented as ancient scripture in the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham.
So when we pull back and look at this entire chronological pattern, what's the takeaway?
I mean, the evidence is incredibly consistent. Almost every single thing Smith restored was a known, discussed concept in his immediate environment.
And you can see it by what's missing, too.
That's just as powerful. You look at the Book of Mormon, the foundational text. There's no mention of temple marriage, no baptisms for the dead, no word of wisdom, no multiple priesthoods.
None of it.
The absence of those core doctrines, and then their later appearance, after we can trace his exposure to sources like Rigdon, Swedenborg, or Masonry, it strongly suggests they developed after that external influence.
Which brings us back to the core question for you, the listener, to think about. If all of these central restored doctrines have traceable secular contemporary origins, and if they only show up in the timeline after Smith would have learned them,
what does that imply about the nature of divine revelation? Was God restoring ancient truths? Or was God just confirming the most popular ideas circulating in upstate New York in the 1820s and 30s?
It's a profound question to wrestle with.
And if you want to follow this paper trail yourself, we really encourage you to look up the names we mentioned, Alexander Campbell, William Davis, and the primary accounts from David Whitmer and Norris Stearns. You can see the full scope of this 19th century mixtape for yourself.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.